Hello, and welcome everyone to the launch of Oncology Decoded: Cancer Science Meets Clarity. We're very pleased to have you all here and join us virtually as well as in person. The reason why we started this is too often groundbreaking research remains in journals, disconnected from the real-world practice. Our goal is to change that, to translate science into actionable, patient-centered solutions that truly make a difference. We focus on critical gaps in community oncology care and ensuring that no patient is really left behind. What sets us apart is to support our commitment to real-world clinical decision-making rather than simply presenting trial data. I really want to extend our sincere gratitude to Cancer Network for this opportunity, my co-host, Ben Garmazy, for his expertise, collaboration, all of our panel members that are joining us today to launch this first three episodes for Oncology Decoded. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention my wife, Maithri, for supporting me in launching this and developing this and making this a reality. So with that, we will dive into today's discussion with Ben. Do you want to start off with bladder?
Okay, so let's, I guess, do a quick round of introductions. Thanks, everyone. It's a really exciting launch. We hope that this gets translated into something that is intelligible via audio, because the goal is that this is a podcast. And I guess we can all thank our partners. Thanks, Manoj, for making me look bad there. Thanks, Anna. But let's just introduce the people in the session first. So obviously, you know me and Manoj, but Petros, please.
Great to be here. Thank you so much, Manoj and Ben and the Peri Group, for doing this program. It's very important to bridge, right, the data presented in conference with clinical practice, which I think is hugely valuable. I'm Petros Grivas. I'm a medical oncologist in Seattle. I'm a professor of oncology at the University of Washington and Fred Katz Cancer Center. I'm doing plenty of clinical trials in GU malignancies. My focus is on bladder cancer.
I'm David Morris, private group in Nashville, Tennessee, a urologist. So I'm also function on the LUGPA board of directors, which is large independent groups across the U.S. So I'm here as the voice of the simple community urologist.
Yeah, so but I think it's 3-1here, so we'll gang up on Petros, because we're technically, we have only
all
one
community
academic on stage.
We all learn together.
Yeah.
Learning from you.
So the first session is going to be advancing perioperative bladder cancer care. So obviously, we could talk about all sorts of new data in the metastatic setting or new drugs and drug development, which is obviously a big special interest of some of us on the stage, but we're not going to touch that today. We're going to touch real-world perioperative urothelial cancer, and we appreciate the grant support here and MGH Life Sciences for helping us here to do this. All right, now we're going to get into the meat. So the point of this is to be a conversation, right, and we're going to gear it, and I'm speaking to you, Petros, we're going to gear it for real-world applications. So we don't want to talk too much about hazard ratios. We don't want to talk too much about OS. We want to talk about what do you actually do and why do you do it, okay? So we're going to breeze through the slides real quick, because it's an educational event, and this is, we can come back to if we need to dive in. So we're basically looking at a patient, right? So you got a 60-year-old male with hematuria, mild dysuria, and they end up getting diagnosed with muscle-invasive bladder cancer, but no evidence of distant metastatic disease and no nodal involvement on your scans. Creatinine clearance is 49 mL per minute. You don't have to memorize this. We're not going to specifically talk about this patient. But maybe they have hearing loss, a little bit of hearing loss, but no neuropathy, ECOG performance status one, they wear hearing aids. These are real patients, right? And this is an identity of this patient doesn't fit clinical trials, right? But this patient comes to our clinics. So we're going to talk about this. But first, to crystallize in about 3 minutes, we give neoadjuvant cisplatin-based chemotherapy because of a lot of trials that tell us that it provides a survival advantage. This is looking at MVAC chemo versus cystectomy alone, and there's a reduction in death by about 33%. There are other trials that support this modality as well. But we also know that in the community setting, there's dose-dense MVAC, which is a combination of multiple chemotherapies, and then there's gemcitabine cisplatin, and sometimes gemcitabine carboplatin doublet regimens that can be used in the neoadjuvant setting. We now have data, this data is out of France, that shows a comparative setting looking at dose-dense MVAC, a combination of four chemotherapies versus gemcitabine cisplatin, which is harder to give, but it does look like there's a signal of benefit to giving that more harsh regimen in patients who can tolerate it versus gemcitabine cisplatin alone. And we also know that the dose seems to matter, and this is something that gets lost on. Now, this is picking apart that data set, a different data set, but you look, And you can see in Dostansenvec, those blue lines, those dark blue lines, that if you're giving 4, 5, or 6 cycles, you're getting more benefit than if you're giving less than 4 cycles. And that same trend can be seen with gemcitabine cisplatin based on 4 cycles or less than 4 cycles. It seems like Dostansenvec 4 plus is getting you more benefit than those other modalities. And this is phase 2 data, AURA trial, showing just forget this is a difference. It's avelumab plus chemotherapy. It's not FDA approved, but it's another data set that shows that Dostansenvec is performing better than GemCis, this time in combination with chemotherapy. Which brings us to the newest phase 3 trial on the block, the NIAGARA study, which is randomizing patients with muscle-invasive bladder cancer to gemcitabine, cisplatin, durvalumab, a PD-L1 inhibitor, versus gemcitabine, cisplatin. And then also continuing in the adjuvant setting, durvalumab, that PD-L1 inhibitor. The thing I highlight in red for those of you in the room or those of you watching online, the creatinine clearance on this trial was 40 because they allowed split dose cisplatin, which is great because that's a real world thing people are doing in their clinics to take care of their patients, to offer them cisplatin instead of carboplatin to allow for that worse renal function. These patients can tolerate that better. Now, there's some issues with this study, right? Because in the real world in the US, control arm of no adjuvant therapy versus adjuvant nivolumab, which is FDA approved. So we can talk about that, but that's how this trial was designed. And now we know that there's a benefit here for both event-free survival as well as overall survival. And earlier today presented looking at a benefit, even more data showing benefits that even in patients with pathologic CRs, there may be a benefit for the addition of durvalumab in that setting as well. Unclear how much the neoadjuvant versus the adjuvant part of that trial makes that difference. And then I am going to focus on PASCR in this trial, 37.3%. I said I wasn't going to use hard numbers, but I just did. 37.3% in the durvalumab arm, which is the intervention arm, 27.5% PASCR rate in the control arm. And then you have to wonder, well, how does that stack up with what we've seen before? And I prepared this beautiful slide that I'm very happy about, but I don't have time to go into. At the bottom is the NIAGARA, right, the 37 and the 27. And then if you look at the top highlighted in green, those are meta-analyses that show what is it actually? Dostansenvec, which is the chemotherapy we mentioned earlier, at 35, GemCis at 25, right? So kind of the control arms are actually behaving appropriately here. And then you see all these other immunotherapy regimens, and you can get up to 40, 47, 49%, a lot higher potentially with Dostansenvec and immunotherapy.
Let me just ask you the question.
Yeah, go ahead.
If you go back to your slide here, you're showing a 2% difference, right? Is that really worth the toxicity?
2% PASCR rate?
No. Yeah, you're talking about 35 versus 37, right? You're talking about Dostansenvec of 35.2 versus NIAGARA, GemCis Durva of 37.3. You're talking longer duration of therapy, cost, toxicity.
So you're saying GemCis Durva is longer duration of therapy and cost and toxicity. I see where you're going with it.
So is that worth it?
Well, remember, 2% is the same. We're not going to do that kind of cross-trial comparison.
Fair enough.
But I think that's what we should talk about. And I think let's just pop it up right here. Before we get into that question, though, let's level set. So we got a urologist on stage. and I think we're going to pick on the urologist on stage. So sorry about that, Dr. Morris. But you're sending your patients to a medical oncologist. What do you want them to give?
I mean, historically, it was GemCis. And the second line therapy was anything except carboplatin. And I think you've shifted some of that attention to Dostansenvec. But honestly, from a urology perspective, it's honestly, I'm going to leave that to you. It's more the idea that everyone should be presented the option of getting neoadjuvant therapy. That's where we fail. Because we see the patient, we think they're a little too sick. I think I know what the cis ineligible criteria are. And so I kind of shoehorn them and say, we're just going to move forward with surgery. And we're having a lot more bladder preservation. And so the first decision is just getting the urologist to say, we need to have another person from a multi-D perspective talk to this patient before we jump into something surgical.
Can I push you a little bit?
Sure.
So if you send your patient to a medical oncologist and they were to give carboplatin gemcitabine, how would you feel about that?
I would not be as excited.
Petros, do you think he's right or wrong?
I agree with David that patients who cannot safely get cisplatin, they should not get carboplatin. So if I had one message today for our friends and colleagues in practice, do not use carboplatin in the neoadjuvant setting. If you can give cisplatin, we can talk about who can be cisplatin eligible patients. Go for it. Ideally, cisplatin-based chemotherapy plus checkpoint inhibition is the standard of care, in my opinion. But if you cannot give cisplatin safely, the options could be radical cystectomy upfront with lymph node dissection, or clinical trial, if available and eligible, and bladder preservation can be another strategy right. in fit patients.
Well, so why would you not use carboplatin?
Great question, Manoj. So we have done trials with carboplatin in the neoadjuvant setting, phase two trials, you know, back in the days when I was at the University of Michigan, and the bottom line is the pathological complete response rate seems slightly lower compared to those achieved with cisplatin, and there's also the worry about potential immunosuppression and potentially delaying curative intent radical surgery. So in the absence of level one evidence that we have with cisplatin-based chemotherapy, I do not use carboplatin as my neoadjuvant or adjuvant approach for muscle-invasive bladder cancer. I may use carbogem for metastatic disease at some point, right. and we'll talk about that in another setting, but I'm not using carbo for neoadjuvant therapy because of those reasons.
And what about, you said not an adjuvant either.
For bladder cancer, no, I
but
do not.
But it changes if you're doing upper tract.
Great question. Upper tract, I would say there is a lot of nuanced discussion with the patient, Ben. It's one of the longest discussions in my clinic. Adjuvant therapy of resected upper tract after, you know, nephrourectomy. I'm struggling with this because the prospective data are not that clear. If the patient never got neoadjuvant chemo and they can get cisplatin for upper tract, I give adjuvant Gem/Cis there. If they cannot get cisplatin, I'm having a dialogue about the uncertainty of the data. I have offered selectively adjuvant carbogem for upper tract based on the subset of the POUT phase 3 trial in UK. I'm even less certain and more ambiguous, and I do not know about adjuvant checkpoint inhibition for upper tract in the adjuvant setting because of the very small sample size and the wide confidence interval there.
So Manoj, what are you doing? Are you ever giving adjuvant carbo, upper tract, lower tract? Does it matter?
Adjuvant carbo I do give, but I immunotherapy for upper tract I have not done as much. It's usually gem carbo, and that's based on the POUT study that Petra's just talking about. The challenge is how they recover post-surgery, right? So sometimes it's more frail patients and it's harder. So that's the group that's more challenging. But just coming backtrack for a second here, you know, we were talking earlier about cisplatin and what you're using for that criteria. What are you, how are you determining that this is a patient that can get cisplatin? Curious to hear the urology perspective as well as the medical oncology perspective, right? I think we all have some judgment in yes or no and how we push the boundaries.
I think it matters more about the urology yeah. opinion, right? Because yeah. you're the one who has to gate, is going to gatekeep those as patients who get referred to medical oncology.
That is the most important thing. And in large practices that have specialized surgeons who do cystectomy, it's not everybody who does a cystectomy. The people who do cystectomies tend to know the data a little bit better. And so we have to make sure first that high-risk people get to the right surgeons to have the conversation before they just jump into surgery so that they even have things offered. But we, it largely is how well we present it to the patient before I even send them to you. If I tell them you're gonna go talk about getting chemotherapy, it's going to make the chance of you recovering after surgery and having minimal tumor and having longer term outcomes that are better, the trade-off is worth it to at least have the conversation. Then I leave it to you to sell them. But if I say, I can send you to get chemo, I don't know if you need to do it, it could make you sick, or we could just do surgery, that's a very different patient interaction. So we have to pave the way for you, but we also have to do it appropriately. I look at creatinine clearance. I don't have any.
What's your cutoff then?
I mean, honestly, for me, if somebody's less than 30, I don't even bother sending them. Everyone in between in the gray zone, I think it's up to you to make the decision what's safe. So I mentioned to them that they may not be an ideal candidate, but there may be things that can be offered.
I think 40 is now potentially something we can tell our audience that is something to start considering split dose, right? Would you ever go below 40, Petros?
Probably not. Yeah. One thing I agree with David, I think it's a message to their colleagues there in practice is if you see a patient in the gray zone, send the patient to medical oncologist to have a discussion about pros and cons. And then, as you said, David, we can have that dialogue. And I look at the totality of the data. Is the patient meeting the other so-called GALTI criteria? And if so, what is my creatinine clearance threshold? And it's changing over time. I would say, based on retrospective data that we published back in the day, around 50 cc per minute was my threshold. I'm now, based on the Niagara data, I may go potentially a little bit lower and do split dose. The data with split dose are not very clear. They may make me feel better, but I don't know if it makes an impact in the outcome. Having said that, very recently I'm doing more and more 24-hour urine collections because I'm interested in the data from Niagara. I'm interested to expand my population of getting, you know, chemo IO. So I'm doing 24-hour urine collection, and I'm capturing more patients with actually higher creatinine clearance that they may give, you know, cisplatin-based chemotherapy as opposed to before. So I'm expanding that utilization. The last point I will make is, and David, correct me, if I have a patient with obstructive uropathy who may benefit from relieving the obstruction and improve their creatinine clearance, nephrostomy tube is preferred over stents because of potential spread with stents for localized disease. So that maneuver, nephrostomy tube and 24-hour urine collection may increase a population who may get chemotherapy with cisplatin.
Let me ask you the question. Logistically, how hard is it to get a 24-hour urine, right? So in a true community oncology setting, it's not a it's not an easy thing to do, right? So you're asking somebody that lives 20, 30 minutes away, collect their urine for a day, bring it back, run the analysis, and then now you're talking about getting on therapy. I don't know, Ben, what are your thoughts? I have not done something like that.
I like the creativity.
Yeah.
I've never done it for that reason. We've only done it for trial patients at our site, right? But
yeah.
Actually, no, I have one patient I'm doing it who's on a kidney cancer combination. We're towing the line with proteinuria, but that's a separate conversation. But I think it's interesting. I think personally, you know, my recommendation to people listening to this podcast is I was using 50 kind of as my personal practice till this came out. I think I'm willing to go down a little bit. When I split the dose, there's two different ways you can do it. I'm kind of doing the day one, day eight, so that patients only have to come in. They get their two drugs day one, they get their two drugs day eight, and it's a little bit easier. The data behind this, you're right, it's not perfect. But we live in an imperfect world, and people have to make decisions with the lives in front of them, right? And so that's what I'm doing. I think I might be comfortable to go down to 40 now. Sounds like you're nodding in agreement, and you're nodding in agreement, and I'm going to pretend he's nodding in agreement. So ambiguous, I mean, everyone is unanimous on this stage. So I think that's good. I think we should move on a little bit, because I want to talk about how we actually pick which therapy we're going to give, because we've alluded to this controversy, but we haven't dug into it. So adjuvant nivolumab is now approved, right? It's an immunotherapy. We just talked about gemcitabine, cisplatin, durvalumab, which is an immunotherapy combination as well. In this situation, you're getting either neoadjuvant chemotherapy or not getting neoadjuvant chemotherapy for muscle invasive bladder cancer, and based on your pathologic outcomes, you have an option to give adjuvant nivolumab. That's anyone who has YPT2 or greater disease at the time of surgery. So this is something to think about, right? Clearly, a disease-free survival benefit and an overall survival benefit. I don't think we need to debate it. This is real, right? These are clear separation of the curves. We're having a dramatic impact on some patients' lives. Now, we heard some great discussions today about how that's a small slice of the pie, but it's a real slice of the pie. And if we had a better way to select patients, maybe we would use that, which brings me to, well, we'll get through this slide real quick. There's data for adjuvant pembrolizumab as well, but a complicated trial. We're going to move past it because it's not something that we're using in practice right now. So, ctDNA, right? Everyone's wondering about ctDNA, both in the academic settings as well as in the community settings, because this is something that is commercially available and reimbursable, right? So this is an easy test to get. And based on a study with adjuvant atezolizumab, so a PD-L1 inhibitor, granted PD-1 and PD-L1 inhibitors are different. Durvalumab is a PD-L1 inhibitor, nivolumab is a PD-1 inhibitor, but here you can see the benefit. While this trial was overall negative, if you look in the ctDNA positive after surgery, you can see there's a benefit of giving immunotherapy. And the ctDNA DNA negative patients, there's not a benefit to immunotherapy, and if anything, a trend towards worse toxicity and perhaps worse outcomes. So that's something to keep in mind. Now, we have a whole lot of trials coming that are going to help us answer this question, but we're in the community. I can't wait. I got a man or a woman right in front of me, right? So we have to make a decision. Now, EV Pembro's coming too, and maybe we'll talk about that and how that might change the perioperative landscape. It obviously blew the water out for frontline metastatic disease. But are we at a point now where we're ready to use ctDNA? Because, and let me frame it as this question, because I think we're probably running out of time, even though our timer's not working right here. So maybe if you can tell us how much time we have in the back. But we have to make a decision now. Gemcitabine, cisplatin, durvalumab is going to be approved. Chemotherapy IO. You're going to give your chemo and your immunotherapy. They're going to get surgery, and then, even if they have an amazing outcome, they're going to continue to get immunotherapy, right? Or we can use gemcitabine cisplatin, or perhaps the better regimen, dostensenvec, grab pathologic features at the time of surgery, look at ctDNA, and make that decision. So is ctDNA ready for clinical practice? And we're going to toss it right over to Petros.
It's a great discussion, and I think the discussion is ongoing literally by week, month by month. If I can summarize my thought, ctDNA is probably the strongest prognostic biomarker we have. We have many clinical trials that shows us the same concept, that it's highly prognostic, correlates with recurrence and survival. The big question is, the slide you showed, Ben, is it predictive of response, or let's say benefit, because adjuvant setting, we're gonna talk about response, but is it predictive of benefit, of survival with adjuvant checkpoint inhibition? The hypothesis was raised in the IMvigor010 trial you showed, but it's not proven yet. There are two ongoing trials. IMvigor011, you showed it, and the modern trial, you showed it in that slide, that are trying to answer this predictive question. Bottom line is, and this exactly is the trials I'm talking about, in the bottom of the slide, modern on the left, lower corner, and the IMvigor011 on the right, lower corner. This will try to answer, is it predictive of benefit to adjuvant checkpoint inhibition? Until we get that, I'm not using yet, or I have not used yet, ctDNA right now, because in the adjuvant setting, because I'm not sure whether it will give me the predictive answer. Having said that, based on the data we're seeing, I may start using it, especially in patients who are on the fence, and this will give us some prognostic data. If ctDNA negative, and they really want to avoid toxicity, that may impact the decision making. I will tell them, though, that we're not 100% sure whether it's predictive, but I think it might inform that dialogue with the patient. So I have not used it yet, but I may start to use it.
Are you getting it on everyone and just not using it to make decisions, or are you just not getting it so you don't have to have that information in front of you?
Good question. Because so far I have not used it for decision making, I have not ordered it. But I will be more open to ordering and inform my discussion with the patient, especially those who are on the fence and they are, you know, they want more information to make an informed decision. So far, I'm using adjuvant nivo based on the CheckMate 274 trial, based on the pathologic states, risk of recurrence, without ctDNA data as of yet, because we don't have data or ctDNA in the CheckMate 274 nivo trial.
So Petros, there's someone on stage here who taught me how to use this. Okay, so I'm gonna throw it over to Manoj now. So how do you use ctDNA? Is it the same or is it different?
Yeah, I actually have a very different approach. And you know, I think it's more, it's not true evidence-based, right? So it's more of practically, is it available? Can you use it? In the era of everything that's more, you know, we have a lot of young patients that are apt to looking things up, right? And they find Signatera, which is commercially available, and like, I want this test, right? So the conversations are more challenging in that you don't know what to do with that, right? And so what I've actually started doing, and I think there's a number of doctors in the community that actually do this, which is you start up front. And I've actually seen a lot of urologic practices that are actually using ctDNA even before start of systemic therapy. And so you get the initial draw if you're expecting it to be positive. If you clear, we do know that you tend to have a better outcome. And then they've been followed. And so I've done it so that you get it up front, you watch them, they clear, and also I had patients that recur on ctDNA up front without imaging or delayed on imaging afterwards. So I've kind of done it in both. And in the metastatic setting, we've seen very clear responses with the use of ctDNA. So much to a point, I don't make clinical decisions based on ctDNA alone, but you kind of know what's happening from an imaging standpoint within a few weeks later.
So you have a patient ctDNA negative, you're offering them adjuvant immunotherapy.
Yeah, it depends on what the CheckMate study showed, right? Like what Petros was talking about. So if they, even though they had residual disease, if they're ctDNA negative, I still offer it.
You're still offering it, you're offering it, you're not sending it. Because the academic's behind the time, so he's not sending it, right?
Not sending it yet. Okay. The ctDNA, the decision about adjuvant nivo is mainly based on the CheckMate 274 trial criteria.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm telling you, I'm on the fence here. I'm starting to flirt. It's Valentine's Day. I'm starting to flirt with the idea that maybe we shouldn't be giving all these patients adjuvant nivolumab, and here's why. If we give adjuvant nivolumab, how is that, one, we're going to overtreat even more patients, right? We know that. We don't know that. We might miss them, and that's the danger. We might miss them. But also with EV Pembro out there in the frontline metastatic setting, exposing patients to immunotherapy when maybe we even have a chance to have them a nice durable response, even if they do recur. So I'm on the fence.
But Ben,
I'm out there on an island, maybe.
But if you're saying you're over-treating, but you may be doing that with Gemcitabine Durva, because they may have a complete pathologic response, and then you're over-treating even with Durva in the adjuvant setting.
And so I guess
you're over-treating regardless.
So what do you want to give? So you have a patient with T3 disease, referred to you by your urologist in Colorado.
So T3N0?
T3N0. What are you doing tomorrow?
Yeah, so what am I doing tomorrow? I'm probably giving him Gemcitabine Durva, or I'm giving him Gemcitabine Nivo, because I can't get Durva for certain set of patients. Okay. But that's usually what I'm giving.
And that's a great discussion, because to your point, Ben, you hit the nail on the head. We're having the risk of over-treatment in many patients, the risk of under-treatment in some patients, because we don't have very accurate biomarkers today to select our patients. I think we're getting there. ctDNA is helping us to get there, and hopefully we can integrate the pathologic response today we saw from Niagara, and we see ctDNA integrated. This may help us more to make informed decisions, but I think we need to see across the different ongoing trials ctDNA data incorporated in the PathCR or non-PathCR to help us make these decisions to try to avoid over and under treatment in the future.
So can I be mean though? I want to ask him the same question.
Okay.
It's Monday. You're back. Nice conference. You're back in Seattle. Someone's in your clinic. T3 disease, neoadjuvant. What are you going to give?
Cisplatin eligible patient.
Cisplatin eligible. Are you going to give Gemcitabine Durva if you could? Obviously, there's some payer issues right now. Let's pretend there aren't for the sake of this podcast. Maybe by the time it's out, there won't be. Or are you thinking about Dostensem back?
I will try to do. And this is a long dialogue, but I will try to do Dostensem VAC plus checkpoint inhibitor. I think, based on the totality of data you showed the AURA trial, Ben, we saw today we had a poster looking at Dostensem VAC plus pembrolizumab in patients with localized muscle-invasive bladder cancer with histology subtypes, variant histologies, a little bit, difference there. We saw a pathologic complete response approaching 60% in those patients, 59%. If you include the patient with CIS or cystectomy. So we have seen safety data. I think that cisplatin-based chemotherapy plus checkpoint inhibition is a standard of care, and I like to have the option of Gemcis or Dostensem VAC. Having said that, if I cannot do that combination in practice, Gemcis durvalumab is very reasonable, and I would continue durvalumab perioperatively, pre and post, until we get more data on Niagara.
And I'm going to be on an island again, because I'm not sure. I am very intrigued. Gemcis Durva is great. So any of my patients that were going to get Gemcis, they're going to get Gemcis Durva, and that is probably the majority of community oncology, because Dostensem VAC is harder to give, it's harder to tolerate, right? And not everyone's eligible. But if I have a patient that's eligible for Dostensem VAC, and I can't, let's pretend I can't get the immunotherapy approval because I'm not at an academic center and I can't write that paragraph to get it approved, right? Or whatever it's going to take from the payers. But would I consider Dostensem VAC and then providing adjuvant immunotherapy on the back end for that patient? The answer is yes. I think I might. So I might be alone here on the stage saying that I might still give Dostensem VAC with adjuvant immunotherapy. I'd like to do it, neoadjuvant. I look at this data on this slide here. You've presented great data at this conference, but there's other data that was presented at ESMO showing near 50% past CR rates, right, with these combinations. So I would like, with Durva, by the way. So I would like to do that, but I might give Dostensem VAC to a DDMVAC eligible patient still, even with the level high quality data that we have from this phase 3 trial, and then provide adjuvant immunotherapy, and maybe I would have fun and flirt with the ctDNA at the time to help me make the decision on who needs that immunotherapy. I don't think we know what's right. I think we just confused everyone listening to this podcast, but I will say I am outvoted, and Petros is smarter than me, and Manoj is smarter than me, so go with them.
One quick comment, Manoj, to interrupt. It's a really great dialogue. In my thinking is that if you add chemotherapy with checkpoint inhibition from the neoadjuvant setting, you may potentially capture more clones, heterogeneity of disease, and that may achieve more higher disease control. And extrapolating, of course, with all the caveats, Ben, from other tumor types, if you put in the neoadjuvant setting the immunotherapy, it might, in theory, have tried to eradicate micrometastasis early on. So these are theoretical reasons, but I think until we get more data from other trials, chemoimmunotherapy is a reasonable start, And again, with the caveats of potential overtreatment in some patients, in the absence of reliable biomarker, it seems reasonable for now. And one last comment before Manoj, you comment too. We saw in the answers, Ben, that people opted for Pembro EV, pembrolizumab perfortumab.
Right.
For now, the data is in metastatic disease. We do not have data yet from phase three trials in localized disease. We're waiting for this data soon, so stay tuned for MIBC data with Pembro EV.
We're all assuming that that's going to replace this entire conversation that we had, but we do have to wait, right? We do have to wait till it shows that. I know you were going to say something. And then
since we have Dr. Morris on the stage, I do want to ask this thought-provoking question. I'm curious to hear the thoughts from the three of you, as both of you guys as well. You know, we generally think about resectability, right? And is this a surgical candidate or not, while we were talking about cisplatin eligible and such. But if you have a patient that is lymph nodes higher up, you know, and we don't generally want to do surgery because you're thinking there's micrometastatic disease elsewhere. In the era of all these new drugs, and you're giving them Gemcis Nevo, right? Because technically you're now calling them M1 disease, and now they've had this remarkable response. Would you take them to surgery? And would you say that this is now a curative intent and you've now converted them? How do you, I mean, that's still kind of coming into this perioperative space, even though you started off as thinking that they're truly metastatic.
So downstaging and consolidative surgery in aggressive surgical places will happen. And it will happen in our market. If you have somebody that nodes disappear and we feel with restaging or ctDNA, I feel like there's a chance at cure for the youngest, healthiest patient. For these sicker, frailer patients, we may just take the win and then move to bladder preservation treatment as opposed to surgical therapy, which is gonna have a measurable mortality.
It's a great discussion, and I can tell you we have patients in clinic right now, to your point, David, that we have this N2 and 3 scenarios with pelvic-only disease, lymph nodes, maybe borderline M1A. We may start EV Pembro. They have a fantastic response. What do we do? We don't really know. The technical standard of care is to continue Pembro EV as for the EV-302 trial, but you're starting to flare, to use your term, you know, Valentine's Day, with the idea of potential consolidation. So we're designing trials to try to answer this question. Is there value added by consolidation? And until we get those answers in the future, it's a case by case. Age of the patient, medical comorbidities, for Juan's status, surgical suitability, how high up are the lymph nodes, how deep is the response, how motivated they are to potentially stop systemic therapy. We don't know if it's the right thing or not, but all those factors play in to decide on an individual patient level whether to do consolidation or not. And if we do consolidation, is it chemoradiation? Is it surgery? We try to literally make it up as we go, and we need to capture this data to learn from those cases and ideally need trials.
Okay, I think we'll conclude because we have to move on to the next section. So thank you to our panel. I think that was a great discussion. Hopefully you enjoyed it if you're listening at home.
Thank you, Petros. Thank you, Dr. Morris.